And so when we start talking about the disease outbreak, it's not even just the direct impact and the biological lag to replenishment, but it's also the multiplicative impact in terms of further upstream on that system. When we start thinking about the cost of a disease outbreak, I'm a consumer. We're all consumers first and foremost, even those producers. And so I think we think of the retail prices. And so obviously we see the changes in retail prices for my eggs at the grocery store. I see the changes in my chicken prices or turkey or milk or whatever the case is. But there's also the cost of the biosecurity that Dr. Potesky was talking about, just this, these practices have to go into place, and those are additional costs. There's additional costs for the monitoring and surveillance, for the cleaning and disinfections. There's additional costs for the testing, and that's going to be to the producer, to the integrator, to government officials, to the testing labs. There's also time and effort involved in all of these different situations. And then also us as a consumer, where we're having to process our risk perceptions of those types of foods. And so the costs aren't just the direct ones that we can see. And so when we start thinking about how those affect the entire supply chain, they are all up and down the supply chain, and they're multiplicative along the line.
H5 influenza isn't going away. We're going to have changes in how we raise animals and how we do things, because this virus will become endemic and it will continue to be a scourge. My big thing is, I think that disease control should be separated from trade, because I think they're separate issues, and we shouldn't be able to choose trade over disease control or the health of humans and animals.
Farmers need help. We're dealing with something unprecedented, and that there are no short-term solutions. We need to think medium to long-term at this point. And I think ultimately we really need to think strategically for the first time about where we have our animal agricultural facilities relative to habitat for wildlife.
Prices are going to be impacted because of the of birds being taken out of the system. We're going to see those ebbs and flows as commodity prices go up and down related to supply, but that the supply you are consuming should be safe and healthy to consume, that eggs in the marketplace aren't coming from diseased animals, that if you cook your meat to safe levels, I think all the reports show that it's going to kill the virus, and so that our food supply is still healthy. Our prices might be high, but they should come down when supplies come back on. And that everybody is working as hard as they can to try to mitigate this disease as well as they can and as quick as they can.
You've been listening to experts speak about the outbreak of bird flu in the U.S., where things might be going, and what people need to know. H5N1 isn't going away. Farmers need help because short-term solutions aren't cutting it, and prices are going to continue to be impacted because of birds getting this disease. For KBOO, I'm Althea Billings.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
I'm David Hunt. In the conclusion of my two-part feature on MECLA, I'll examine the slow decline and demise of America's first gay and lesbian political action committee.
MECLA became involved because bathhouses were embarrassing to explain.
MECLA is dying a slow death, she said in September 1991. That was the problem, literally, not figuratively. A scan of the obituary section of the Los Angeles Times tells the story.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Daniel Wasias. 56 men are arrested at a so-called gay sex party in Jakarta, Argentina's president decrees an end to gender-affirming healthcare for young people, and AIDS kills America's first queer political action committee. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Elena Botkin-Levy.
And I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 15th, 2025. Indonesian authorities are calling it a gay sex party. They arrested 56 men during a raid at a private gathering in a Jakarta hotel on February 1st. Police spokesman Aid Ari Siam Indradi told a press conference, "The event was merely based on pleasure that they wanted to seek. Condoms and HIV medications were also seized. The suspects are being charged under the nation's pornography laws and face a minimum of 2 years in prison. Two men who allegedly rented the hotel room and another who allegedly invited the partygoers could be in jail for up to 15 years if convicted. Sex between men is technically not illegal under Indonesian secular law. However, LGBTQ people face routine discrimination and harassment in the primarily Muslim nation, and when arrested, they're charged with other crimes." John Sifton is the Asia Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. He told Metro Weekly, "The prosecution of people under the anti-pornography law is one problem. Those who are arrested are sometimes beaten, extorted for money, and have their property confiscated from them. There are also provisions in the penal code against obscene acts by others with third parties that they've used to prosecute people as well." Indradi underscored the police's interest in both legal and social expectations. He concluded the press briefing about the raid with the troubling admonishment, "Let this serve as a reminder for everyone to uphold the law and moral decency."
Argentina's far-right president, Javier Milei, signed a decree this week banning gender-affirming healthcare for trans and non-binary patients under the age of 18. The decree also forces transgender inmates to be housed in jail facilities based on their birth gender. Presidential spokesperson Manuel Adorni explained that Milei's action had been informed by legislation restricting pediatric gender-affirming healthcare in the UK, Sweden, Finland, and the United States. It repeals a 2012 gender identity law that allowed the treatments with the consent of the young patient's parents or guardians. An official government statement argues, "Gender ideology, taken to the extreme and applied to children by force or psychological coercion, simply constitutes child abuse. Children do not have the cognitive maturity to make decisions about irreversible processes." The government failed to provide any evidence that children were being coerced to change gender or that puberty blockers and hormone therapies are irreversible. Milei created a stir at last week's World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, where he condemned wokeism, feminism, and climate activism, referred to LGBTQ people as pedophiles, and called Pope Francis a filthy leftist. That drew thousands of protesters into the streets of Buenos Aires. The global queer rights group ILGA World bemoaned developments in Argentina in a statement saying, "Argentina was a beacon in the region. By recognizing the right to gender identity without pathologization or judicialization, this regression, imposed by decree without parliamentary debate or the participation of the sectors affected, constitutes an abuse of executive power and a blow to democratic institutions."
Another president's attempt to ban gender-affirming healthcare for trans patients under the age of 19 by decree is being blocked by the courts. Judge Brendan Herson of the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland was the first to issue a temporary restraining order to halt a January 29th executive order by President Donald Trump. Herson's February 13th ruling granted the request from seven families with trans or non-binary children who are challenging the constitutionality of Trump's order. They're joined by PFLAG National and represented by queer and human rights legal organizations, including Lambda Legal and the American Civil Liberties Union. The temporary restraining order lasts for 14 days, but it can be extended, which seems likely. Observing the steep challenges already facing trans people, Herson wrote that Trump's executive order exacerbates and seems to deny that this population even exists or deserves to exist. The next day, U.S. District Court Judge Lauren King of the Western District of Washington granted a second temporary restraining order. This one in response to a lawsuit filed by three doctors and the Democratic Attorneys General of Washington State, Oregon, and Minnesota. Their lawsuit argues that Trump's order discriminates against patients on the basis of sex and additionally intrudes on states' powers to regulate medical care. Hospitals across the country have obeyed in advance and stopped dispensing puberty blockers and hormone therapy for their young trans patients, fearing the loss of federal funding. The temporary restraining orders should ensure that practitioners will continue or resume those services, at least for now.
Transgender and non-binary people are also suing the Trump administration over a presidential directive. Seven plaintiffs are challenging his demand that the U.S. State Department stop offering the X gender marker on passports and other federal government documents. The American Civil Liberties Union is representing them and says it has already heard from more than 1,500 trans people or their family members about difficulties they're having getting a passport. In the words of ACLU legal director Jesse Rossman, it's yet another example of the Trump administration attempting to deny the dignity of transgender people and trying to push them out of public life. We're challenging this unconstitutional passport policy because all people deserve the freedom to live their life safely and with dignity.
Finally,
hell no, we won't go! Hell no, we won't go! Hell no!
Hundreds gathered at the birthplace of the modern LGBTQ+ movement to protest another absurdly transphobic action by the Trump administration. Since by executive order, the United States now recognizes only two genders, the National Park Service has erased the T, Q, and plus sign from LGBTQ+ on the official website of the Stonewall National Monument. All references to transgender people are gone, and the word queer has disappeared. It's particularly ironic, as New York State Senator Brad Hoyleman Siegel told CBS News,
"The transgender community threw the first bricks that launched the contemporary LGBTQ human rights movement."
Trans folks, especially trans women of color, black and brown trans women, were at the forefront of the LGBT movement back in 1969 when the Stonewall Inn was being raided.
Trans Latina activist Angelica Cristina spoke to WPIX.
"And I always make sure to speak their names. Marsha P. Johnson, Sylvia Rivera, Miss Major Griffin Gracie, and queer people like Stormy DeLavier."
Another protester told Fox News 5,
"It's not only about removing letters from our website, it's a coordinated attack to remove or try to erase trans, queer, non-binary people from the entire government system to say that we do not exist."
Gay New York City council member Eric Botcher also attended the rally.
"Trump and his people are trying to cleave our community apart. They're trying to pit us against each other. They're not going to succeed."
New York Governor Kathy Hochul called the erasure cruel and petty. Kathy Rina of the National LGBT Task Force put it into perspective for ABC News.
"It's just another part of the chaos and cascade of attacks that the queer community is facing under the Trump administration. The pendulum swings both ways and progress is not linear. No, we're not going anywhere."
The demonstrators at the Stonewall Inn in Greenwich Village have a warning.
"For those who think that they're going to stop at T, they're going to remove all the other letters.
When they're done with us, they're coming for you!
When they're done with us, they're coming for you!
When they're done with us, they're coming for you!"
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending February 15th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Michael Taylor Gray. Stay healthy.
And I'm Elena Botkin-Levy. Stay safe. Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
It invented checkbook activism in the 1980s at the beginning of what seemed like a budding romance with a who's who of U.S. liberal politicians. In last week's first of a two-part series, we recounted the rise of MECLA, the Municipal Elections Committee of Los Angeles. However, in a system driven by money, even LGBTQ-supportive candidates become gold diggers, and MECLA discovered that money could ultimately not buy love. In the confusion of his two-part series, This Way Out's David Hunt reveals how the country's first gay and lesbian political action committee died.
In the 1980s, the Reagan Revolution swept the United States, turning the country to the right. As the gay and lesbian movement struggled for social and political acceptance, one group was thriving. MECLA, the Municipal Elections Committee of Los Angeles, used its wealth and influence to attract Democratic and Republican candidates to its events at luxury venues, such as the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. But the good times didn't last for long. This week, in the conclusion of my two-part feature on MECLA, I'll examine the slow decline and demise of America's first gay and lesbian political action committee. I'm David Hunt. In 1982, California Governor Jerry Brown appeared at one of MECLA's breakfast meetings to seek its endorsement and money for his Senate campaign. He had taken a fair amount of heat, Brown told the group, for supporting gay and lesbian causes.
In many ways, you gathered here this morning are exactly what people are talking about when they start their political assaults on my record and what I've been trying to do in Sacramento. There are code words, there are innuendos, but basically people don't like the fact that I've had a record of enfranchising the disenfranchised and representing the unrepresented.
It's true that, as governor, Brown had appointed gays and lesbians to positions of power in the state. He appointed MECLA board member Sheldon Andelson to the Board of Regents of the University of California, on the condition that Andelson sell his gay bathhouse, the 8709, in West Hollywood. And Brown appointed the state's first openly gay judge, Stephen Lax, to the San Francisco Superior Court, and the first out lesbian, Mary Morgan, to the San Francisco Municipal Court. Brown's appearance at the MECLA breakfast should have been a love fest, except someone asked Brown about his controversial decision to shelve a series of public service ads about AIDS, a disease increasingly claiming the lives of sexually active gay men. Brown waved off the issue, noting that the state was cutting spending across the board, not just in areas that affected gays. But he was pressed about the ads, which, it turns out, were already produced and already paid for. It wouldn't cost the state anything to spread the word about the emerging epidemic, and it might even save lives. Brown hedged.
I will review this matter carefully and slowly, and we will come up with a satisfactory solution relatively soon.
The audience laughed because they understood what Brown was really saying. He didn't want the ads to air until after he finished his campaign for Senate. He might be attacked during the campaign for spending money on gay health care while cutting other health programs. It was a fight he chose to walk away from. Mekla's board of directors voted overwhelmingly to endorse Brown, while recognizing that his support for the gay community had its limits. Brown ultimately lost the Senate race, and despite his promise, the public service ads never aired. Mekla, the first gay and lesbian political action committee in the United States, faced criticism in the early 1980s that it was too easy, that it demanded too little of the candidates it supported. The LA Weekly explained it this way. The real problem the new gay power structure poses is that it often reduces the political process to check writing, leaving the vast majority of gays disenfranchised. The grassroots can be trampled with such a strategy. Bella Abzug, the first representative to introduce a gay rights bill in Congress, addressed a Mekla breakfast a few months after Brown. She suggested that the group didn't have as much power as it thought it did.
I mean, women are not in the system. I mean, gays are not in the system. Minorities are not in the system. I mean, we got a few representatives here and there, but we're not in the system. We're outside of the power structure. There's no question about it. We're trying constantly to influence it, to push it, to give it money, to push it around, to say, listen, we got power, you better pay attention to us. But essentially, we're out of the system. So you pay a little attention to us because every vote counts. When 52% of the people in the country are voting, then every vote counts. So you can't take any chances. So you come around and you have a breakfast and a dinner and a lunch to all kinds of groups. Feminist groups and gay groups and old folks and, but anyhow, women are generally not in power. We know that. Even in this room, we don't seem to be in too much power. laugh, but take it seriously. Anyhow, you don't mind my saying that, do you?
Stung by the criticism, Mekla tried to change the impression that it was a boys' club. I reported on Mekla's progress for Pacifica Radio after attending the group's annual fundraising dinner in 1985.
3 years ago, Bella Abzug surveyed a room full of men at a Mekla breakfast meeting and urged them to involve more women in the organization. Tonight, Geraldine Ferraro surveyed a dining room crowded with men and women at the Century Plaza Hotel and applauded their efforts to work together for human rights for all Americans. This year's dinner, Mekla's eighth annual, showed how far the organization has come in its efforts to include women, as well as men, Republicans as well as Democrats in its ranks. Ferraro talked of her growing awareness of gay and lesbian oppression and the need for oppressed groups to work together for social justice.
When we fight for the Equal Rights Amendment, it's not just because the Equal Rights Amendment is good for women, but because it's good for men and women together. And by the same token, when we fight prejudice based on sexual orientation, we not only protect the victims, we also heal the sickness that breeds irrational hatred. And that will be good for all the American people.
You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. The limits of Mekla's power became clear as it struggled to win passage of a gay employment rights bill, AB1, in the state legislature. The measure had been introduced 5 times since 1975 by San Francisco Assemblyman Art Agnos. It finally passed the legislature in 1984, only to be vetoed by Governor George Dukmejian. It's also true that for all the media attention Mekla generated, its budget paled in comparison to the dollars raised by rival groups on the right. While Mekla worked to raise $1 million to support friendly candidates in the decade of the 1980s, in 1 year alone, 1984, the Moral Majority raised $11 million for its right-wing lobbying efforts. To make matters worse, Mekla's board of directors decided to wade into a political battle that would divide the gay and lesbian community in 1985. It sided with conservatives on the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors and called for the voluntary closure of gay bathhouses. In Mekla's view, bathhouses were a public health threat because they fueled the spread of AIDS, full stop. That view was shared by many of its supporters and, more importantly, by the California political establishment. Craig Hume, chair of MECLA's communications committee, explained.
Many members of the state assembly and state senate have indicated that they thought MECLA took a very responsible stand, which significantly enhanced the image of the gay community in the eyes of our elected officials.
Steve Downard, a bathhouse owner and head of the Silver Lake Merchants Association in Los Angeles, was one of MECLA's sharpest critics. In his view, the group cared more about public image than public health.
MECLA became involved because bathhouses were embarrassing to explain to their fabulous West Side friends. Well, maybe they have become like their fabulous West Side friends at Bel Air cocktail parties, but the rest of the gay community isn't. And the rest of the gay community may not have the affluence to defend their civil liberties as easily as the Board of MECLA.
In the end, the County Board of Supervisors opted to keep LA's 20 bathhouses open, but did require them to take steps to monitor and discourage unsafe sexual activity. If the controversy hurt MECLA's standing inside the gay and lesbian community, it boosted its reputation as politically pragmatic to the rest of the world. It helped MECLA court moderate Republicans, those could still be found in the 1980s, like former San Diego Mayor Pete Wilson, who had soundly defeated Jerry Brown in the 1982 race for the U.S. Senate in California. Wilson was warmly greeted at a MECLA dinner in July 1987, shortly after he successfully pressured the Reagan administration to create a National AIDS Commission. Wilson went on to win re-election to the Senate from California in 1988, beating his Democratic opponent, Leo McCarthy, by nearly a million votes. Then he surprised everyone by running for California governor in 1990. He beat former San Francisco Mayor Dianne Feinstein by about a quarter million votes. If MECLA thought it had a friend in the California governor's mansion, it was wrong. Less than a year into his term, Wilson vetoed AB1, the employment rights measure that MECLA and other gay organizations had been pushing for over a decade. Reaction in the gay and lesbian community was quick and fierce. Checkbook activism, critics said, was a fool's game. Judy Cisneros, a member of Queer Nation and ACT UP, two groups that embraced street protests, derided MECLA as gay assimilationists whose influence was waning. She told the LA Weekly, direct action and civil disobedience may become the most effective way to fight for broad-based recognition and laws in a society as resistant to gays and lesbians as ours. Even establishment figures such as Tori Osborne, executive director of LA's Gay Center, could see the writing on the wall. MECLA is dying a slow death, she said in September 1991. That was the problem, literally, not figuratively. A scan of the obituary section of the Los Angeles Times tells the story. One of MECLA's top donors, Sheldon Andelson, died of AIDS in December 1987. MECLA's first chair and one of its co-founders, Peter Scott, died of the disease in May 1989. By the early 1990s, the epidemic had claimed more members, including MECLA founders William Carey, Richard Kaplan, and Rand Schrader. As a result of the losses in its ranks, MECLA faced both a leadership void and what Osborne called grief overload. David Mixner told the Los Angeles Times in 1992 that he had lost nearly 200 friends to the epidemic. MECLA's finances began to suffer. Co-chair Ryan Nakagawa told the LA Weekly that the group's annual budget had dropped tenfold, from $300,000 or more in the mid-1980s to just $30,000 in 1991. By 1992, MECLA was history. Co-founder David Mixner turned his talents to raising money for an old college friend who just happened to be a leading candidate for president. Reflecting on MECLA's demise, Mixner told the LA Weekly, "MECLA began to die a slow death as most of us began to turn our attention from gay issues to AIDS." But he defended the group's tactics, believing that courting and supporting gay-friendly candidates was necessary to raising the profile of a long marginalized movement. As long as you believe the political process is important, you need checkbook activism, he said, if you want to play politics. In its 15-year existence from 1977 to 1992, MECLA certainly played politics, and in a way that no one in the gay community had ever played it before, by the rules of the establishment, by cleaning up, dressing up, and sitting down with the politically powerful. If they didn't achieve everything they wanted, they at least were taken seriously by serious people. Morris Kite, the scruffy old-school activist who organized LA's first gay pride parade in 1970 and founded the Stonewall Democratic Club in 1975, was never invited to a MECLA dinner. I'm not sure he even owned a tuxedo. But he knew something about working inside and outside the system. The movement needed to cultivate a good cop, bad cop strategy, he said in 1991, combining street protest and political lobbying efforts. MECLA was needed, he said, because some of us must know how to talk the language of legislators. And that language, as anyone can tell you, is money. MECLA is long gone, but its legacy lives on today in organizations like the Human Rights Campaign, the LGBTQ Victory Fund, and Equality California. I'd like to thank the One National Gay and Lesbian Archives for preserving many of the recordings heard on this program. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
To hear the full version of this feature, visit David Hunt's blog at www.tellmedavid.com. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Elena Botkin-Levy and Michael Taylor Gray, and produced by Brian DeShazer. David Hunt produced this week's feature. Billy Joel, Alice Cooper, and Ite Kashti performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Harry Richardson of Socorro, New Mexico, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media. Email us at info@thiswayout.org or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappelle, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Daniel Macias. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on WLSL, St. Leo Dade City, Florida, CFUV, Victoria, British Columbia, KYRS, Medical Lake, Spokane, Washington, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
You are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
March 7th, 1965. The American Dream and the American Negro by James Baldwin. The Southern oligarchy, which has still today so very much power in Washington, was created by my labor and my sweat and the violation of my women and the murder of my children. None can challenge that statement. It is a matter of historical record.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. First gay imam assassinated in South Africa, violent New Zealand Christians attack drag king Storytime, and the Baldwin of yesterday speaks to black lives today. Those stories and more this week now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm Melanie Keller.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending February 22nd, 2025. The world's first out gay imam is dead, killed in broad daylight on the streets of the South African city of Ngabira. The car Mussin Hendricks was riding in was blocked off by a pickup truck, as seen on closed-circuit video. Two hooded figures emerged from the truck and opened fire into the back seat where Hendricks was sitting. His driver was uninjured. Eastern Cape police say the motive is unknown and the investigation is ongoing. To South Africa's second biggest political party, the nature of the killing strongly suggests a professional hit, as a Democratic Alliance representative told the CBC. The 57-year-old Hendricks came out as gay in 1996. He held his first meetings in his home, then in a mosque he established where all Muslims could pray without judgment. The February 15th murder sent shockwaves throughout the queer Muslim community and local and global equality advocacy groups. The International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association called on local authorities to thoroughly investigate what we fear may be a hate crime. ILGA World Executive Director Julia Ert called Hendricks' life a testament to the healing that solidarity across communities can bring in everyone's lives. The Muslim Judicial Council and the United Ulama Council of South Africa condemned the killing. Both leading South African Muslim organizations consistently criticize Hendricks' efforts at reconciliation. Both maintain the traditional view of Islam that the Quran prohibits romantic same-gender relationships. His high-profile advocacy made Hendricks the frequent target of death threats. In the 2022 documentary, The Radical, he said about his coming out, "The need to be authentic was greater than the fear to die." Mussin Hendricks' funeral was reportedly held in Cape Town.
About 30 young children and adults are traumatized after the invasion into an Auckland, New Zealand drag king story time by some 50 far-right Christians. Hugo Girls' February 15th event was part of the city's annual LGBTQ Pride celebration. The disruptive protesters affiliated with the fundamentalist Destiny Church punched, pushed, and shoved their way inside the building, according to local media accounts. When they refused to leave, the event organizers were eventually forced to cancel. Auckland Police Inspector Simon Walker thinks the protesters crossed the line. In his words, the group's actions caused considerable distress and concern among children, library staff, and visitors. Nobody, especially children, should ever be made to feel unsafe. Walker says that the investigation is in the early stages. Several hours after the library attack, Destiny Church members broke through barricades and tried to block the Auckland Rainbow Parade. Police forced them to disperse without any physical confrontations. No arrests have been announced.
Judge Anna Reyes says the claim that trans pronoun use undermines troop effectiveness is frankly ridiculous. She heard arguments on February 18th in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia challenging President Donald Trump's executive order to ban military service by qualified transgender enlistees. Reyes found some of the government's arguments biologically inaccurate and called them simply evidence of unadulterated animus towards trans people. The lesbian jurist demanded, "Can we agree that the greatest fighting force that world history has ever seen is not going to be impacted in any way by less than 1% of the soldiers using a different pronoun than others might want to call them?" Reyes is clearly expected to rule for the plaintiffs. Jennifer Levi is Senior Director of Transgender and Queer Rights for GLBTQ Legal Advocates and Defenders, or GLAD Law. Her group has joined with the National Center for Lesbian Rights to represent the plaintiffs. Levi told the Washington Blade, "The government cannot justify discharging transgender troops who have honorably served our country for years." Judge Reyes still must officially decide whether to issue a temporary restraining order blocking implementation of Trump's January 27th anti-trans order. Earlier this month, another group of transgender service members filed a separate challenge to the ban on Fifth and First Amendment grounds in a federal court in Washington state. They're represented by attorneys from Lambda Legal and the Human Rights Campaign.
Kansas Democratic Governor Laura Kelly tried again, but the third time the overwhelming Republican majority in the state legislature overrode her veto
of a measure outlawing pediatric gender-affirming health care. It's one of the nation's harshest trans health care bans. Providers can be stripped of their medical licenses for unprofessional conduct or sued by individuals for treating young trans patients. Even the use of state funds to provide psychological support for transgender youth is prohibited. Virtually every professional medical and mental health organization in the U.S. endorses pediatric gender-affirming healthcare. Experts agree that for some patients, it can literally be life-saving. Kansas joins more than half of the states in the country to enact some form of restriction or ban on gender-affirming healthcare for trans young people. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in a case challenging Tennessee's ban late last year. It's expected to announce a ruling before the end of its current term this June.
Other Democratic governors are on the front lines battling the federal anti-LGBTQ plus onslaught. Trump called out Maine Governor Janet Mills over her state's policy in favor of transgender student athletes at a February 21st White House meeting.
Is Maine here, the governor of Maine?
Huh?
Are you not going to comply with it?
I'm complying with state and federal laws.
We are the federal law. So you better comply, because otherwise you're not getting any federal funding.
See you in court.
Governor Janet Mills says she won't be intimidated by Trump's threats or by an investigation into Maine's policies by the Department of Education. Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker skewered the Trump administration during his annual State of the State address on February 19th, reaffirming his state's safe haven for LGBTQ plus people. Pritzker echoed the stark warnings of Lutheran pastor Martin Niemöller about Adolf Hitler's rise to power, one ostracized group at a time.
The authoritarian playbook is laid bare here. They point to a group of people who don't look like you and tell you to blame them for your problems. I just have one question. What comes next? After we've discriminated against, deported, or disparaged all the immigrants and the gay and lesbian and transgender people, the developmentally disabled, the women, and the minorities, once we've ostracized our neighbors and betrayed our friends, after that, when the problems we started with are still there staring us in the face, what comes next? All the atrocities of human history lurk in the answer to that question. And if we don't want to repeat history, then for God's sake, in this moment, we'd better be strong enough to learn from it.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker.
Finally, questions abound about how much art will survive at Washington, D.C.'s John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. The former star of The Apprentice has said, "You're fired," to the Progressive Board of Trustees and installed himself as chair at the home of the annual Kennedy Center Honors. Just before what's seen as a hostile takeover, the center announced the cancellation of A Peacock Among Pigeons, celebrating 50 years of pride. The special World Pride performance, starring the city's Gay Men's Chorus with the National Symphony Orchestra, had been scheduled for May 21st. NSO Executive Director Gene Davidson blamed the postponement on financial and scheduling factors. The center will produce a pride-honoring performance of The Wizard of Oz to take its place. The chorus will now perform A Peacock Among Pigeons during World Pride's International Choral Festival. A statement from the Gay Men's Chorus called the decision deeply disappointing. The group vows to advocate for artistic expression that reflects the depth and diversity of our community and country. We will continue to sing and raise our voices for equality. Meanwhile, artists have already launched protest actions around the Kennedy Center.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending February 22nd, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay healthy.
And I'm Melanie Keller. Stay safe.
Ooh.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Precious Lord, take my hand and lead me on.
Sixty years ago this month, black gay author, activist, and public intellectual James Baldwin was invited to be a guest of the Cambridge Union, the University of Cambridge's historic debate and free speech society. None of the Southern segregationist politicians they asked would agree to appear with Baldwin. So the student organizers booked conservative founder of the National Review, William F. Buckley Jr., for the verbal face-off. Baldwin was widely credited with winning the February 18, 1965 debate.
Thank you.
3 days later, Malcolm X was assassinated. Baldwin returned to the U.S. for the Selma, Alabama Voting Rights March, and the New York Times published Buckley's remarks from Cambridge and the version of Baldwin's words you'll hear read today on March 7th. The very day Alabama state troopers beat the marchers trying to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Now a goal is Montgomery.
This is an unlawful assembly. You are to disperse. You are ordered to disperse.
In a June 1965 debate rematch on David Susskind's TV talk show Open End, Baldwin succumbed to Buckley's shock and awe verbiage. Years later, he's reported to have said, "To my eternal dishonor, I cooled it. I drew back and I lost the debate. I should have beat him over the head with the coffee cup."
George Floyd!
What's his name?
George Floyd!
George Floyd!
George Floyd! George Floyd! George Floyd!
I can't breathe!
I can't breathe!
In June of 2020, the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officers had redoubled the Black Lives Matter movement and brought millions of protesters into the streets around the world. Meanwhile, This Way Out's Brian DeShazer was producing an online Pride Month global queer read-in. Los Angeles-based multidisciplinary performing artist Paul Outlaw resonated with how Baldwin addressed Cambridge's 1965 debate topic, "The American Dream is at the expense of the American Negro." With the possible exception of the word Negro, Baldwin's speech about black lives under white supremacy could hardly be more current. Here is Paul Outlaw.
March 7th, 1965. "The American Dream and the American Negro" by James Baldwin. I find myself, not for the first time, in the position of a kind of Jeremiah. It would seem to me that the question before the House is a proposition horribly loaded, that one's response to that question depends on where you find yourself in the world, what your sense of reality is. That is, it depends on assumptions we hold so deeply as to be scarcely aware of them. The white South African, or Mississippi sharecropper, or Alabama sheriff, has at bottom a system of reality which compels them really to believe, when they face the Negro, that this woman, this man, this child must be insane to attack the system to which he owes his entire identity. We speak about expense. There are several ways of addressing oneself to some attempt to find out what that word means here. From a very literal point of view, the harbors and the ports and the railroads of the country, the economy, especially in the South, could not conceivably be what they are if it had not been, and this is still so, for cheap labor. I am speaking very seriously, and this is not an overstatement. I picked cotton. I carried it to the market. I built the railroad under someone else's whip for nothing. For nothing. The Southern oligarchy, which has still today so very much power in Washington, and therefore some power in the world, was created by my labor and my sweat and the violation of my women and the murder of my children. This in the land of the free, the home of the brave. None can challenge that statement. It is a matter of historical record. In the Deep South, you are dealing with a sheriff or a landlord or a landlady or a girl at the Western Union desk. She doesn't know quite whom she is dealing with, by which I mean, if you are not part of a town, and if you are a northern neighbor, it shows in a million ways. She simply knows that it is an unknown quantity, and she wants nothing to have to do with it. You have to wait a while to get your telegram. We've all been through it. By the time you get to be a man, it is fairly easy to deal with. But what happens to the poor white man's, the poor white woman's mind? It is this. They have been raised to believe, and by now they helplessly believe, that no matter how terrible some of their lives may be, and no matter what disaster overtakes them, there is one consolation, like a heavenly revelation. At least they are not black. I suggest that of all the terrible things that could happen to a human being, that is one of the worst. I suggest that what has happened to the white Southerner is in some ways much worse than what has happened to the Negroes there. Sheriff Clark in Selma, Alabama, cannot be dismissed as a total monster. I am sure he loves his wife and children and likes to get drunk. One has to assume he is a man like me. But he does not know what drives him to use the club, to menace with the gun and use the cattle prod. Something awful must have happened to a human being to be able to put a cattle prod against a woman's breasts. What happens to the woman is ghastly. What happens to the man who does it is in some ways much, much worse. Their moral lives have been destroyed by the plague called color. This is not being done 100 years ago, but in 1965, and in a country which is pleased with what we call prosperity, with a certain amount of social coherence, which calls itself a civilized nation and which espouses the notion of freedom in the world. If it were white people being murdered, the government would find some way of doing something about it. We have a civil rights bill now. We had the 15th Amendment nearly 100 years ago. If it was not honored then, I have no reason to be believing that the Civil Rights Bill will be honored now. The American soil is full of corpses of my ancestors through 400 years and at least three wars. Why is my freedom, my citizenship in question now? What one begs American people to do for all sakes is simply to accept our history. It seems to me, when I watch Americans in Europe, that what they don't know about Europeans is what they don't know about me. They're not trying to be nasty to the French girl or rude to the French waiter. They did not know that they hurt their feelings. They didn't have any sense that this particular man and this particular woman were human beings. They walked over them with the same sort of bland ignorance and condescension, the charm and cheerfulness with which they had patted me on the head and which made them upset when I was upset. When I was brought up, I was taught in American history books that Africa had no history and that neither had I. I was a savage about whom the least said the better, who had been saved by Europe and who had been brought to America. Of course, I believed it. I didn't have much choice. These were the only books there were. Everyone else seemed to agree. If you went out of Harlem, the whole world agreed. What you saw was much bigger, whiter, cleaner, safer. The garbage was collected, the children were happy. You could go back home, and it would seem, of course, that this was an act of God. You belonged where white people put you. It's only since World War II that there has been a counter image in the world. That image has not come about because of any legislation by any American government, but because Africa was suddenly on the stage of the world and Africans had to be dealt with in a way they had never been dealt with before. This gave the American Negro, for the first time, a sense of himself not as a savage. It has created and will create a great many conundrums. One of the things the white world does not know, but I think I know, is that black people are just like everybody else. We are also mercenaries, dictators, murderers, liars. We are human too. Unless we can establish some kind of dialogue between those people who enjoy the American dream and those people who have not achieved it, we will be in terrible trouble. This is what concerns me most. We are sitting in this room, and we are all civilized. We can talk to each other, at least on certain levels, so that we can walk out of here assuming that the measure of our politeness has some effect on the world. I remember when the ex-attorney general, Mr. Robert Kennedy, said that it was conceivable that in 40 years in America, we might have a Negro president. That sounded like a very emancipated statement to white people. They were not in Harlem when this statement was first heard. They did not hear the laughter and bitterness and scorn with which this statement was greeted. From the point of view of the man in the Harlem barbershop, Bobby Kennedy only got here yesterday, and now he's already on his way to the presidency. We were here for 400 years, and now he tells us that maybe in 40 years, if you are good, we may let you become president. Perhaps I can be reasoned with, but I don't know. Neither does Martin Luther King. None of us knows how to deal with people whom the white world has so long ignored, who don't believe anything the white world says, and don't believe entirely anything I or Martin say. You can't blame them. It seems to me that the city of New York has had, for example, Negroes in it for a very long time. The city of New York was able in the last 15 years to reconstruct itself, to tear down buildings and raise great new ones, and has done nothing whatever except build housing projects, mainly in the ghettos, for the Negroes. And of course, the Negroes hate it. The children can't bear it. They want to move out of the ghettos. If American pretensions were based on more honest assessments of life, it would not mean for Negroes that when someone says urban renewal, some Negroes are going to be thrown out into the streets, which is what it means now. It is a terrible thing for an entire people to surrender to the notion that 1/9 of its population is beneath them, Until that moment comes when we, the Americans, are able to accept the fact that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity, that we need each other, that I am not a ward of America, I am not an object of missionary charity, I am one of the people who built the country. Until this moment comes, there is scarcely any hope for the American dream.
Because the people who are denied participation in it, by their very presence,
they will wreck it.
And if that happens, it's a very grave moment for the West. Thank you.
You've been listening to Paul Outlaw reading James Baldwin's 1965 essay, The American Dream and the American Negro. You can find out more about Paul Outlaw at outlawplay.com. Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Michael LeBeau and Melanie Keller and produced by Brian DeShazer, who also produced this week's feature. The Bee Gees and James Baldwin himself performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks Brad Furr of KGAY in Palm Springs, California, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on 2CHR Chestnut, New South Wales, KUCR Riverside, California, WREK Atlanta, Georgia, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.